The rusty patch bumblebee used to be common all over the Midwest. It's now become the first bee species in the continental U.S. to land on the endangered species list. Bee expert Gene Robinson joins us to explain what's going on. Kids' menus at U.S. chain restaurants are just as unhealthy today as they were 5 years ago. That's according to a new study. WBEZ food and health reporter Monica Ng joins us to help understand why. And how would you like to get locked in a room and have to use science to figure your way out?
We basically want to show people that science can be fun, and people don't always associate science and fun in the same sentence, and that it can be relevant to them and also accessible, and also that it can be beautiful.
That's physicist Paul Quiet. He tells us about a new nonprofit escape room that's just opened up in Urbana. But first, a new report finds the number of reported cases of human trafficking in Illinois is rising. That's all coming up on the 21st, just after this news. You're listening to the 21st. Welcome, I'm Nyla Boodoo. There were 198 reported cases of human trafficking last year in Illinois. That's according to a report out yesterday using data from the National Human Trafficking Hotline. We're joined now by Darcy Flynn. She's an associate director of Freedom from Trafficking with Heartland Human Care Services based in Chicago. Darcy, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Darcy, so we saw in 2012, looking at these numbers, almost half the amount that we saw last year. In 2012, about 100 reported cases, 105. Is it alarming to you that this number has almost doubled in the past 4 years based on the data collected by the National Human Trafficking Hotline?
That's a great question. So I think it's easy to assume that increase in calls means an increase in trafficking, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's an increase in trafficking. It means there's an increase in awareness, which more people are calling in to either report trafficking or to say they're in need of services because they've been trafficked.
And when people hear human trafficking, they may not all have the same definition. How do you all at Heartland Alliance, how do you define human trafficking and what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so trafficking happens when anyone is lured into a situation via force, fraud, or coercion for the purposes of forced labor or forced commercial sex.
And so do you actually have to physically be moved to be considered trafficked?
You don't. That's a common myth about human trafficking. A lot of people think you have to cross a country border or even a state border. You don't have to cross any borders or state lines or even zip codes in order to be considered a victim of trafficking.
And what are people being trafficked for? So kind of that said, that's helpful for us to sort of understand how the definitions that we're working with here. What are people being trafficked for in Illinois? What industries are they being put into?
Servitude, hotels, restaurants, nail and hair salons, things like that. And I think, you know, a lot of people don't quite understand, you know, how does a person go from point A to point Z, which is the trafficking situation. And, you know, trafficked victims are just like you and I. They're trying to improve their lives and support their families. Some are trying to stay alive or ensuring their families remain safe. And so they're put into these situations in which they get trapped in because they thought they were pursuing something to make their lives better.
Yeah. Can you explain how that might happen? Because I think for those of us who aren't familiar with it, it might be hard to understand how someone could end up in a situation like this. What do we need to know about this?
Absolutely. So I never want to give traffickers an ounce of credit, but they are smart in that they understand the vulnerabilities that the victims they're trying to approach have. So they dangle that thing that is missing from his or her life. So a job, economic security, education, safety, or love. And they come about and say, I have this. I can give you a job. I can make sure you're safe. I can love you. And they dangle that in front of the victim. And of course, the reality becomes an exploitative, abusive trafficking situation. And victims become trapped because their lives or the lives of those that they love are being threatened. They don't think they have other options. They're not aware of their rights or services available to them. And traffickers are coaching them to believe that law enforcement or even social workers or attorneys aren't on their side and that there's no help or hope for them. So they're really stuck and trapped in these abusive trafficking situations.
You know, that said, Darcy, this information that we're talking about that came out yesterday was compiled from people calling into the National Human Trafficking Hotline. What happens after someone calls that hotline? What happens next normally?
Yeah, so anyone can call in if it's a concerned community member because of something they saw in their community or neighborhood. The hotline will take all the information that they can, and they actually have a database of trained detectives and law enforcement officials who know how to investigate human trafficking, and they relay that information to law enforcement. I think the number is something like 2/3 of law enforcement tips come from the hotline. It is a great way to get law enforcement aware of what's happening in communities.
Right. And I was just going to say that hotline number, we'll repeat it a couple times, but it's 888-373-7888. That's the human trafficking hotline. We've tweeted it out as well. We'll have it on our website if people are trying to find that information. Darcy, for people in the community, people who are calling and reporting in, what should people be looking for? How should people know if this is kind of a red flag or a situation someone should be concerned about?
Yeah, I will say it's pretty hard from, you know, a community member standpoint to identify trafficking in their community at face value. But things we think about, if you see a nail or hair salon that's open at 11 o'clock midnight, right, that's alarming or confusing. So that's one example. If you're in a restaurant and you see any of the staff being verbally or, heaven forbid, physically abused, that's a red flag, right? Any abuse in the workplace doesn't necessarily mean trafficking, but it definitely means something is going wrong. So it's worth reporting and looking into.
And when we think about people who are being trafficked, do we know what percentage of cases are children versus adults?
You know, we don't. I think statistics are very hard to come by. Even this report that came out by the National Human Trafficking Hotline, this is one snapshot of some data. We know it's happening everywhere in the U.S. as well as abroad, but we're always only getting the tip of the iceberg when looking at or considering data on trafficking. It's happening to both adults and children. It's just kind of hard to say comparatively how much is happening on either side.
It happens to both men and women?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. When we think about the numbers for Illinois, I wanted to talk about Illinois a little bit and what we know about what people are being trafficked for here. But I wanted to ask, you know, Chicago is a major transportation hub. We're sort of known geographically, the whole state. You know, obviously, this is what has been a big part of our economy is just our geographic location. And that makes us a great transshipment point for goods and services across the country. Does that make Illinois and Chicago more of a target in terms of how many more people are possibly trafficked through here?
Absolutely. We have an international airport. As you said, we are a hub, so it definitely increases the susceptibility of trafficking. I also think if you look at a heat map of where the calls are coming from, specific to this report, Chicago is going to have more calls, but we also have more resources and awareness happening in Chicago versus a small town in central or southern Illinois, but it is happening in central and southern Illinois too. And you're right, people are being kind of passed through. We see a lot of survivors who actually were not trafficked in Chicago or even in Illinois, but they have come here to escape their trafficking. So that's something to keep in mind as well.
Mm-hmm. And how does Illinois compare then to other states in the U.S. when we look at cases and calls of things being reported?
Yeah, again, I think comparatively, it's hard to say, you know, comparing us to other cities. I think we're kind of on par in terms of it's happening a lot in cities, or at least it's being reported more in cities. But for example, roughly 75,000 migrant farm workers come to Illinois each year. We know that hundreds, if not thousands of them are being exploited to some extent, just based on what we know and understand about the migrant farm worker community and the profession. But for a variety of reasons and barriers, they're not captured in this report. They're not captured in a lot of other data sets when it comes to human trafficking. And so, again, we're always only getting the tip of the iceberg.
And Darcy, that's, you mentioned migrant workers and agriculture. That's something you were on the program before talking about previously. That's an industry people might not think of where people are being trafficked in agriculture. Are there other industries that people might think about? I know you mentioned hair salons, restaurants across Illinois. Are there other industries we should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think when people hear hotels, their mind still jumps to commercial sex and prostitution. But in fact, what we know is a lot of people who are being hired by hotels to service the rooms, to clean the rooms, to work in the kitchen at hotels, those are the people who we're seeing are being trafficked and exploited. So again, a lot of these industries you and I go to, right? Hotels, restaurants, perhaps we get our nails done or our hair done. These are, you know, the public is interfacing with these communities, which is why it's difficult to identify the abuse, because you can't really portray abuse among your staff because people are going to call the authorities, right? And so that's why it does make it difficult to identify the trafficking.
Darcy, I know that Heartland Alliance has worked to help push legislation in recent years to draw more awareness for human trafficking around Illinois. Can I ask you what's in place right now to kind of what are the laws in Illinois look like in terms of identifying and helping survivors of trafficking?
Absolutely. So at Heartland, we're committed to developing and supporting laws that are comprehensive and holistic. So we're always pushing through or supporting laws that include both sex and labor trafficking, males, females, LGBTQ survivors, as well as adults and children, as you mentioned. So in 2015, we helped to pass a posting bill, which requires a variety of businesses and establishments to post the hotline number, which you just gave. And it also requires hotels to place that same flyer in their break rooms. We know based on research that requiring the hotline to be posted in public places, that's the most important provision for increasing the number of human trafficking arrests, and research tells us that. So we've really pushed to require by law that businesses and establishments post that hotline number.
And if other businesses and establishments voluntarily want to post those posters, where can they find out more information on that, Darcy?
Absolutely. So the Illinois Department of Human Services is the entity that created the flyer, and it's on their website. So IllinoisDHS.gov or ILDHS.gov is the website. And you can download it in, I think, 15 or 19 different languages. So it's available depending on the community that is entering your business. You can print it in a bunch of different languages.
Darcy Flynn is the Associate Director of Freedom from Trafficking with the Heartland Alliance, joining us from Chicago to help us understand more about numbers yesterday about reported cases of human trafficking. Darcy, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much.
That data we were talking about came from the National Human Trafficking Hotline. We wanted to share that number again for everyone listening. If you or someone you know needs help, the National Human Trafficking Hotline is 1-888-373-7888. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It is the first day of February, even if it doesn't feel like it. We're going to be optimistic about Groundhog Day tomorrow, regardless of the outcome, and say that spring is just around the corner. Spring is a time that many of us look forward to for the new growth and new flowers. And of course, along with flowers come bees. There's one species of bumblebee that we may not see around as much anymore. It's the rusty patched bumblebee. It used to be a common sight throughout the Midwest. Its numbers have declined so much that it just became the first bee species in the continental U.S. to land on the endangered species list. That protected status is given by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It goes into effect next week. To help us understand more, we're joined now in studio by one of the world's leading experts on bees. He's the director of the Institute for Genomic Biology at the University of Illinois, where he also teaches entomology. Gene Robinson is in studio with me. Hi, Gene. Thanks for being here.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
So what's happening with the rusty-patched bumblebee?
Well, what's happening with this bumblebee is what we see happening for other species as well, and honeybees as well. And that is we're seeing a decline in the populations. Species that previously had been quite prevalent or individuals were easily spotted, they're becoming more rare and more rare. This particular species hasn't been seen in quite some time now, precipitating this this action, which is, you know, a mixed bag. On one hand, it's a sad realization of where we've gotten to with these very, very important creatures. On the other hand, maybe this attention will be what's needed to help turn things around.
So, Gene, when you say you haven't seen it, does it mean the populations have declined so much that they're literally not, it's something that really, what I guess I'm wondering, at what level do you get to endangered in terms of numbers when you're thinking about a bee species?
Yeah, I mean, you look at really precipitous declines and then a very, very small number of sightings. I think this particular species hasn't been seen in quite some time now.
And since we're talking about sightings, I wonder if you can describe a little bit of what they look like. Earlier, we were looking at pictures. I tweeted out a picture of one, by the way. They're kind of fuzzy. They're very cute. Can you describe what the rusty patch bumblebee particular looks like? It's different than a honeybee.
Yes. Yeah. So it's bigger than a honeybee. It has the same body design, three basic body parts, head, thorax, and abdomen, and two pairs of wings, six legs. So it's the basic insect design and the basic bee design. A key feature of bees is, as you said, they're fuzzy. They're very hairy. Their hairs actually are, the technical word is plumose, and a simpler way to think about them is they're sort of like split ends. So they just divide it finer and finer, and this allows the pollen to adhere to their bodies. So they are, many of their features are adapted to have this coevolution with plants and insects to, I should say, reflect this coevolution of plants and insects, and in this case, for bumblebees, to be able to carry pollen efficiently from one flower to the other.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a lot more about that specific process, that pollinator role that bees play, why that's an important thing for agriculture, for the ecosystem here in Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We are talking about the rusty-patched bumblebee. Next week, its protected status as being endangered will take effect. That's a designation by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The rusty-patched bumblebee used to be a common sight throughout the Midwest. It's actually become the first bee species in the continental U.S. to land on this endangered species list. Joining us to explain what's going on, the role that bees play, I think we've all heard about the declining bee population across the U.S. generally, is one of the world's leading experts on bees who's right here in Illinois. He's the head of the Institute for Genomic Biology. He also teaches entomology at the University of Illinois. Gene Robinson is in studio with me. Gene, you were just saying before the break, you were just sort of describing the structure of bees, their physical makeup, and why they're really important. And I think many people hear the term pollinators. We know bees play an important role in pollinating flowers and food production. We looked it up earlier. We saw some estimates anywhere from a third to nearly three quarters of the world's food crop rely to some extent on bees. Why is that?
So plants have two different ways of reproducing. One way is they produce pollen and it's spread by the wind and then it goes to other plants and then instigates the whole reproductive process that results, of course, in seeds and then vegetation and so forth. The other process requires animals to actually move the pollen from one plant to another. The pollen is stickier. It just doesn't blow in the wind the way the other species' pollen do. And so they require, these plants will require animals to physically move the pollen from one plant to another. Insects are the premier pollinators on the planet for this group. And of the animal pollinators, it's the bees that are the premier animals pollinating. So they are really very important for many different crops in our agricultural systems. These are crops that are very important from a nutritional point of view, fruit crops, vegetables, seed crops, a lot of the food that adds important nutrition and breadth and diversity to our diet.
And Jean, I imagine that a lot of crops grown here in Illinois for the agricultural industry, what crops in particular would be dependent on pollinators?
So squashes, apples, things of that nature, sunflowers.
Okay.
Alfalfa.
And alfalfa.
I can keep going, but I'll stop.
Okay. And why and what is it particularly, the rusty patch bumblebee, is that something that was at one point in time native to Illinois and to the Midwest?
Yes. So bumblebees are native to the Western Hemisphere, native to North America. By contrast, honeybees are not. Honeybees were introduced to North America. Bumblebees are native, so they have co-evolved with a lot of our plants in this area. They also, as a result, are associated with their being native to climates like this. They can forage in cooler weather than honeybees. Honeybees originated in the tropics. They have expanded their range. They do a magnificent job in a variety of climates pollinating. But bumblebees, this is kind of their home turf. They're adapted to this area, and they are able to forage under cooler temperatures, which is very important because many of the crops are flowering early in the spring when it is cooler.
And if the rusty patch bumblebee is on the decline, as you're saying, not really seeing very many sightings at all, which is why they're now on the endangered species list, does that mean would honeybees take over the role of pollinating? Would other bee species take over or be able to make up that difference in terms of the pollinating role?
Well, that's a very, very important question. We don't know the answer to that because it's not clear what this situation represents. Is this bumblebee a canary in a coal mine? And it indicates that the populations of other species also are declining. That would sort of say that it might be hard to pick up the slack. That's actually what we do suspect because the declines in bumblebee populations are mirrored by declines in honeybee populations. So we really do see a threat to our nation's food supply with a decline in the populations of multiple species. This one is getting the attention first because of the severe decline, but there are other stories like this, and certainly we see this with honeybees as well.
I think people, Jean, might actually be surprised to learn, because I think we've seen so much media reports about the decline of the bee population across the U.S. People might be surprised this is actually the first time that bees are on the endangered species list. What do we know about, I know there's lots of theories and questions about why the bee population generally, when we're not just talking about bumblebees, but honeybees, the entire species is on the decline. Can you tell us a little bit about where that's happening? Is that happening across the world? Do we know why?
So the declines have been noted now for about 10 years. This is actually the 11th year since the major calamity first started being noticed. And after this amount of time, we now have a pretty good handle on the scope of the problem in terms of identifying the main factors. The problem is that it's quite complicated. There is no single smoking gun. There are many people that are passionate about blaming the situation on one particular factor. But in fact, a consensus is starting to emerge in the scientific community that it's multifactorial. There are four factors primarily at play. One is pathogens. The second is parasites. The third is pesticides, and the fourth is poor nutrition. And so there's evidence that all four of these are involved in weakening bees, stressing bees, and the very interesting and problematic discovery is that these factors interact in as yet very unpredictable ways.
And so when you say pathogens, what do you mean by that?
Viruses, bacteria.
That are just affecting bees?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so these are pathogens that, in some cases, these viruses have been around and they weren't serious at all. But now a bee that's stressed with something else, a parasite or exposure to a pesticide, or it's not getting as much nutrition because there are fewer flowers available to it, this virus that previously they were able to tolerate, now it becomes more deadly.
Jean, do scientists believe we caused this? Humans caused all of this?
Well, it's complicated. So certainly there are changes in agriculture, changes in land use pattern that are contributing. The pathogens have been around. Pathogens and parasites are factors that have been around for some time. They also have been spread. We have a lot of trafficking of various substances in agriculture, commodities in agriculture. Bees are no exception. They have been moved around different parts of the world and have contributed to the spread. But the current situation is to really try to address the unpredictable interactions between these factors, and where most of the studies go on with honeybees because they are better studied. But we feel that the basic pattern and the framework is holding for bumblebees as well. Honeybees and bumblebees are cousins.
I'm speaking with Jean Robinson. We're talking in particular about the rusty patch bumblebee. We've been talking about bees a lot, but in particular, that's the Midwestern bee that has now been placed on the endangered species list. We've actually got a caller. Jean, can I ask you, can you put your headphones on so you can hear the caller who's
sure.
Just so you can hear the question that he's going to ask
mm-hmm.
as well. Hey, Joe, welcome to the 21st. What's your question?
Hi, I work with a lot of farmers who are using cover crops here in Central Illinois, and I was just curious if, I'm not sure if you know what sort of plants are being used as cover crops, but if there's anything in particular that could be planted to help the rusty patch bumblebee and other pollinators.
Yeah, anything farmers can do. Yeah, thanks for that call, Joe.
That's a great question, and there are many flowers, plants with certain kinds of flowers that are very attractive to bees. These can be planted as cover crops. They also can be planted by gardeners and landowners anywhere. The more flowers that are bee-friendly flowers, the better. So there are lists that are available that indicate which plants produce flowers that are attractive. Alfalfa, various kinds of clover, which are used as cover crops in this area, are really attractive to bees. Buckwheat, which is used to be used, I think is less so. You probably know more than I do about that, but that's a crop that's been really, really very attractive to bees, those flowers. Sunflowers are another one that's grown in this area. So there are a variety of plants that produce flowers that are very attractive to bees. And the more bee-friendly flowers, the better the situation, both in gardens as well as in our fields.
And now that the rusty-patched bumblebee is on the endangered species list, what does that mean in terms of, are there any special regulations that come into effect in terms of this? I know this is a list created by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Are there any extra protections in place that will also try to help the population, Jean?
Well, there's a lot of encouragement to improve practices and to safeguard. So reading the labels carefully on pesticides and applying them according to regulations is something that's being encouraged now because of this, or I should say encouraged more. There are land use changes that are being encouraged. Other aspects of the pollinator protection program that was developed by the previous administration are in effect and will be further encouraged as a result of this.
What do you want the average person listening to know about this? Maybe people who are gardeners or people who kind of hear these stories about bees in decline and now about, in particular, the rusty patch bumblebee.
Well, I think we could distill it into to two particular topics. One is that bees are tremendous pollinators. They do an amazing job pollinating, in part because of their social life. So bumblebees are social insects. Honeybees are social insects. And what this means is that when you see a bee out collecting food, she's not collecting it for herself. She's not stopping off for a meal and going to continue on to something else. She's collecting food for her younger sisters, and that's for the good of the colony. And so these individuals that are out collecting food are pollinator machines. They're out there moving from flower to flower, collecting as much as they can. Evolution has sculpted them into pollinating machines with superb navigating abilities, behavioral mechanisms to be able to collect as much pollen as possible and spread it in ways that are appropriate for helping plants to reproduce. So bumblebees live in societies, small societies. Honeybees live in much larger societies, but both are highly social, and that contributes to their big impact. They have an outsized impact on the environment because of their sociality. So that would be one thing. And then the second thing is, just to repeat what I said before, one thing that anyone can do is to encourage the growth of more flowers and to encourage responsible use of pesticides. Both of these are very important.
Gene Robinson is an entomologist with the University of Illinois. He's the director of the Institute for Genomic Biology. Gene, thanks for being with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Speaking of food, we know that fast food isn't the best thing for kids, but several years ago, a nationwide initiative known as the Kids Live Well program was launched by the National Restaurants Association. The goal was to promote more healthy options on kids' menus. Well, a new study from the Harvard School of Public Health shows that despite that effort, kids' menus at U.S. chain restaurants are just as unhealthy today as they were 5 years ago. To help us understand more about this and several other recent news headlines, we're joined now by WBEZ's food and health reporter, Monica Ng. She's on the line with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Monica, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
What did researchers find in this study about fast food menus and kids' menus?
Well, they found that despite this program that's supposed to improve the quality of the menus, they really haven't changed that much, and that, in fact, about 80% of the beverage options are still sweet drinks.
And so is it just that the healthy options aren't available, or is it just that kids aren't choosing them?
Well, that wasn't clear, because basically they just analyzed what's actually being offered on the menu. But they do say that, you know, some of the new healthier options are still sweetened milk and sweet tea. And if you're talking about the consumption of sugar through liquids, which can hit your system much faster and, you know, arguably contribute more to obesity, that doesn't help things much. So, you know, you can also talk to any kid and say, if you were offered a glass of water or that sweet milk, what would you choose? I think probably, you know, if the kids are choosing rather than the parents, they're choosing the sweet drinks. But unfortunately, this data looked at what's being offered.
Okay. And so let me ask you just about another report. This was from a CDC report about the rising consumption of sugary drinks among kids. And this was also kind of, to the sugary drink point, not great news for how much kids are drinking.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, if you're going to be offering these kids and 80% of these healthy meals sweet drinks, it looks like they want to grab them. 2/3 of all kids are having at least one sweet drink a day, and about 1/3 are having two. And again, you know, the links of obesity, heart disease, all sorts of, you know, type 2 diabetes, to sweet drinks does not make this seem like quite a healthy trend. I mean, there have been studies looking at that, and in general in the United States, soda consumption has gone down. Sugary beverage consumption has gone down. And actually, if you do compare these numbers from the 2009-2010 numbers, these numbers came from 2011-14, kids were drinking about 155 calories of sugar a day back then. Now it's 143. That's not a huge change.
Well, at least it's going down, right? So when you say sweet drinks, that doesn't mean just soda then. What else do you include
right,
in sugary?
We're talking about Gatorade. We're talking about juices. You know, juices, which every parent was like, yay, I give my kids juice. And then they say, I give my kids 100% juice. They pretty much act the same.
Right.
Because it's when your body's processing, it's sugar is sugar, and it's liquid sugar that your body is processing very quickly and can be turned into fat.
Okay. So in that sense, I mean, guides for parents, I mean, need to be thinking, it sounds like parents need to be thinking a little bit more about juice or milk or just sort of looking at that sugar content, Monica?
Yeah. I mean, the latest recommendation is one sugary drink a week for young children.
A week?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean,
this
science has been revisited, and a lot of people are still scratching their heads. They're like, juice? You mean like pure orange juice? That's not okay. Well, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics is saying, let's reduce that a lot.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Monica Ng, talking food and health. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest from WBEZ in Chicago Public Media is Monica Ng. She covers food and health. We've been talking about fast food. We've been talking about sugary drinks. Monica, I'm going to just talk about one other thing that happens in fast food meals, and that's the apples. The apples that are the healthy option that's available in some fast food meals. I know the other day my 5-year-old niece refused to eat it because she said it tasted weird. She said, I don't like how they taste. They taste too chemically. I wanted to ask you about this because there's now genetically modified apples that are coming to grocery stores in the Midwest this month. They're non-browning apples. So can you tell us about that?
Sure. They've got a gene that's been changed to slow an enzyme that contributes to browning. And, you know, they say this is the first GMO product going directly to consumers that has a clear benefit to consumers. They think it might be a game changer in terms of how people see GMOs. Other people say, well, we'd like to see this studied more. And other critics say, you know what, if these don't brown, how can we know visually that this might be an older product that we might not want to have?
Oh, okay. So that's an interesting question. They might not be. Is it possible that they could be bad but not brown? So I guess you would just know when you bit into it if it was like mushy?
Yeah, I mean, they'd have to go through other clues rather than the browning. And so, you know, some people say, is this something we really need? And other people say, well, if it gets kids to eat more fruit, isn't that a good thing? So there are a lot of pros and cons on this one.
Right, and that's the thing. Like right now, like with the apples, the ones that you get that are, do they spray something on them so they don't brown? Is that why they kind of taste a little chemically?
Usually ascorbic acid, which is, you know, you find it a lot in lemons. You know, some people say put lemons on your fruit so that they don't brown so quickly. And I haven't seen any studies that say ascorbic acid is bad, but I guess people are saying if it's already in the gene of the apple, you don't even have to have that second application there.
Right. So it's kind of interesting to see if kids pick it or not. Before I let you go, Monica, I just wanted to ask, there's been so much news in Washington about President Trump's nominees and policies. I just wanted to ask you about what the general expectations are, what you're hearing from different food advocates in the food community about the new administration.
Sure, lightning round on this. Meat. Meat people are unhappy. About 60% of our red meat goes to NAFTA and TPP countries, so they do not like to feel like there's a slowing in that. The meat packing industry relies highly on refugees. Ever since undocumented workers were cracked down on, refugees are the go-to. So meat packing, not happy. Those who've always felt like regulations from FDA and EPA were too onerous on food, they're happy to hear about this regulation reform.
Right. Sonny Perdue, right, is the pick for agricultural secretary, obviously someone from the industry.
Mm-hmm. Former Georgia governor. Some people, like Tom Vilsack, has given him his nod of approval. This is the only outgoing secretary who's given the nod of approval to the next proposed one. But others say that he was really slow to act when Georgia had its peanut crisis. And he is in the peanut industry. And lastly, people are really nervous about a breakdown in trade with Mexico, who buys and trades a huge amount of food back and forth between the United States. You know, guacamole lovers, this could, by some accounts, mean 10% more on each avocado.
10%.
10 cents
more per avocado, right? We've seen a lot of that. Avocado, I guess, other, when we do rely a lot on Mexico, Monica, for a lot of different food imports.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. A huge amount. And people are saying, you know, this is really going to hurt those really important imports between the two countries.
Right. And so
to move their products back and forth because they don't know when this is going to break down.
Right. So lots of things.
Trade associations and companies wrote a letter, including Cargill and Tyson, saying, do not mess with NAFTA, Trump.
So did you say 130, Monica?
130 trade associations and food companies wrote a letter to the Trump administration saying, look, we depend on NAFTA to keep this trade flowing.
It's WBEZ's Monica Ng. She covers food and health for us, covering lots of different issues for us. Monica, thanks for that. Always great to have you on.
Same here. Take care.
If getting locked in a room with a group of friends and having to use science to figure your way out sounds like your idea of a good time, then an escape room might be just the thing for you. In Central Illinois, there's a new venue for doing just that. It's called Lab Escape. It's located in Urbana. at the Lincoln Square Mall. They had their grand opening last weekend. Our producer, Christine Herman, tagged along with a group of five students from the Society of Women Engineers at the University of Illinois and brought us back this postcard of how their day went.
It's like playing a board game, but being physically in the space and physically immersed in the puzzles and the teamwork aspect of it.
It's like the game of Clue.
Yeah.
My name is Cece, and I'm a third-year graduate student in electrical engineering. I work with these ladies, like, all the time. It's always fun to get to know them better.
Being an engineer, we like problem-solving, and I know that's what I really like about it, is, like, looking for the clues and, like, using your mind creatively to problem-solve.
So we have some notes on, like, wavelengths and different physics topics, so I guess we're just reviewing them in case we need the info once we're in the escape room.
You guys think you're all ready?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. So as you're about to hear, we are all agents on the same team.
Agents, good to see you. There's not much time, so here's the background. Dr. Alberta Schrodenberg is a professor of physics at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's a true genius. She disappeared 22 days ago. Your first task will be to find the BNC cable to connect up our newly engineered transponder.
Good luck, agents.
Start looking around the rest of the room if you guys want to work on that.
Oh, wait, guys, I found something.
Oh,
what you got? Is there anything with like lasers or lights? Because this is an index of refraction versus selective materials.
I feel like there's still gotta be stuff in that cabinet that we need.
What happens if we get locked
down?
That
means you can't open it.
Permanently?
Dev, put on this lab coat.
Why me?
I don't know.
Aha!
It's for the
W. It's for the, oh, it is.
Camera instructions. Press on off button to turn on and off the camera.
Oh, no, there's stored images in the camera.
Whoa, that's so cool.
What codes do you have for
W, yeah, maybe
X, Y, and Z?
I don't know what the results would be.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh.
Great.
I thought it was crazy how, like, into it we all got. Like, I thought it was just going to be, like, a fun little activity for, you know, 60 minutes. But we were so into it. Like, we were so motivated.
That was a group of University of Illinois students exploring the new escape room in Urbana. It's called Lab Escape. Thanks to Christine Herman for producing that for us. I'm joined in studio by one of the voices you heard. It's the professor who's the brains behind it. Paul Quiot is a physics professor at the University of Illinois. And in studio with me, Paul, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So what's the premise of this? We heard a little bit about that at the beginning, but what's the premise of how this is supposed to work when you get locked into a room?
Yeah, so there's a story line that there's this missing professor, Schrodenberg, who has this lab, and there's some secret research on quantum computing going on, which could have relevance if the information fell into the wrong hands. And so the agents are trying to find out what happened to her and what happened to the other agents that went into the room and never came out again.
So what kind of prior scientific knowledge do you need to have in order to successfully solve this and get out of the room?
You don't need to have any prior knowledge at all. We do provide some information at the outset if people want to look at that, and that's usually pretty helpful. But you certainly don't need to go in with anything. You're not solving any equations. I guess I would say we need the players do well if they have the three C's, if they have curiosity, so they're willing to explore the space and play around with things, and communication, so they can communicate their results to each other, and also collaboration, where they work together to solve problems. And one of the things we really like about that is that's exactly the same characteristics that you need to be a good scientist or a good engineer or anything like that.
And so how many people normally are on a team, and how much time do you have to solve it?
So the optimal size is 4 to 6 people. More than 6 and it gets too crowded, and also then people don't see enough of the puzzles because they're too independent, I guess I would say. And less than 4 becomes a little too challenging in that sense. And the time, we have two sort of level settings, as it were. There's a novice setting, which is 60 minutes, and then a challenge setting, which is 70 minutes. The group of girls you just heard there, they went through the challenge and they rocked it. It was really fun watching them.
So there's, I know there's this episode of The Big Bang Theory where Leonard and Sheldon and the whole gang go into escape room and they're disappointed because they solve all of it in a few minutes and they want a discount. Is there a prize or what happens if you figure it out in less than 60 minutes?
Well, if you figure it out in less than 60 minutes, that means that you've succeeded. So if you're more than 60 minutes, in some sense, you might have succeeded in some of the goals but not actually escaped.
Right.
We do keep a tally of what the shortest times are, and so the best time on our challenge round at the moment is about 50 minutes. And
those, 5-0.
5-0. And they so they had 20 minutes to go, basically. And they were super commandos at doing escape rooms. So actually, they're our friends over at the Champaign-Urbana Adventures in Time and Space escape room.
And what if you don't figure it out? You obviously imagine you're not stuck in there forever.
Oh, no, you're certainly not stuck in there forever. So, you know, our purpose is to expose people to some of the different puzzles because some of them are really amazingly breathtaking to see and really cool. And so if people are kind of on the wrong track, we will try to send some hints in every now and then, even if they're not asking.
How do you do that?
Right. So there's the previous agents have been able to establish a texting terminal in the space. You heard a little bit of a deep, grovelly machine voice speaking there. And so there might be a statement that said something like, agents, can you tell us what's written on the main lab table?
Someone monitoring their – okay.
Assuming that the people are able to hook up – it also mentioned hook up this BNC cable that gives us video access to the room so we can watch everything that's happening.
Okay. So you guys can kind of keep an eye on everything that's happening.
Absolutely.
How did you pick the puzzles?
So I'm a physics professor here, and I teach some introductory physics class, and I really love demos. And so I try to use as many demos in my classes as I can. And so I had some stock of some of those already in my head. And we last spring started with a bunch of undergraduates making a whole bunch of puzzles, and some of them worked out well and others didn't work out as well. All the physical effects are fine, but you need puzzles that are robust enough that they will just keep working and for everyone. And so that can be a challenge to get things to go that way.
So when we say puzzles, what kind of puzzles? Can you give me an example of what kind of puzzle you'd have to try to solve?
Sure. So there's a puzzle that people didn't actually go through, but we certainly could have in where there's a clipboard that seems like it's broken and it's got a bunch of tape on it. And there's a hidden message in the tape. The tape actually changes the polarization of light that goes through. And you can detect that if you have a source of polarized light. For example, like any computer monitor would work for that, although most people don't know that. And then if you have a source to analyze that, like 3D glasses or polarizing sunglasses or something like that. And if you look at this element without those, you just see plastic with no message. But when you see it with it, then amazingly this message just pops out at you.
So, Paul, what's the goal? Is it for you? Is it fun? Is it exposing people to science? Is this a money-making venture? Is it all three?
No, it's certainly not a money-making venture. Sure. We're a non-profit organization, and in fact, if people want to help us with that on our website, you can go and you can help them with donations, which will help us bring other people who may not want to, you know, be able to pay the $20 or $15 an hour or something like that. I would say there are three goals. The most important one, underlying, is that everyone needs to have a good time, otherwise people won't come back, and I think you could hear from the audio there that people do seem to have a pretty good time. Related to science, we basically want to show people that science can be fun, and people don't always associate science and fun in the same sentence, and that it can be relevant to them and also accessible so they can understand things without being able to solve equations, so you can understand how 3D glasses work, for example, and also that it can be beautiful. And some of our puzzles and some of our artwork, I think, is really pretty breathtaking and stunning visually, and so we have those three goals, and I think we've managed to hit all of them.
So who can go to the escape room?
So it's designed for almost anyone. It's probably better ages 12 and above or 7th grade and above, but it's certainly not just for university students. And we'd really like to reach out to people who normally wouldn't consider themselves to do such a thing and maybe have an interest in science, underrepresented people. And so if there are groups like junior high teachers who want to bring the science class there, in groups, then we'd love for them to contact us and we can arrange something.
So they can reach out to Paul Quiat, a physics professor at the University of Illinois, one of the folks behind the new escape room that just opened in Urbana. It's called Lab Escape. Thanks, Paul. And you're actually doing free 10-minute escapes this Friday at the Lab Escape Room from 4 to 7 for anyone who wants to check it out. We'll have all of the information up at our website at 21stshow.org. Paul, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
That does it for us today. We're out of time. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be following up on Caterpillar's surprise announcement yesterday for Peoria, saying they're going to be moving their headquarters from Peoria to Chicago. We've got some officials from Peoria that are going to be joining us, as well as folks from Decatur. If you recall, ADM and Tate and Lyle moved some of their headquarter folks to Chicago a few years ago. That does it for us. As always, all of that information, as I said a minute ago, is at our website. If you want more information about the show, head to 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.